Matt Taibbi. He's a take-no-prisoner, shoot-from-the-hip reporter, columnist, and blogger whose March Rolling Stone article, The Big Takeover, made quite a stir. It paints a very dark picture of greed, corruption, and power. Wall Street, D.C., what else is new? Welcome, Matt Taibbi.
How's it going?
Very well. I like listeners to get a feel. By the way, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, Taibbi.
Taibbi, okay.
Yeah.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas, and you have an interesting path here. You did a college year abroad, but you didn't spend it at Oxford or the Sorbonne. You spent a year at Leningrad State Technical University, and then after college, you moved to Uzbekistan, and then later you worked for the Moscow Times as a sports editor. So what was your time in Russia and Eastern Europe all about?
I was overseas for about 10 or 11 years, actually, after college. And, you know, the sports editor, I actually ended up playing sports overseas.
I know that. What did you play?
I played baseball for the Red Army team in Moscow. And then I played pro basketball in Mongolia for a year.
Oh, who hasn't, you know?
right. That's sort of the standard after college activity, I guess. So, but no, I mean, it was good. I think, I ended up starting a paper in Moscow called The Exile. And I worked on that for 6 or 7 years, with my partner, Mark Ames. And I think it ended up actually, ironically enough, being very good training for what's going on in American politics right now, because a lot of the sort of third world shenanigans that go on are sort of being repeated now in this bailout era, and it's been very interesting to watch the similarities between what's happening now and what was happening in Russia in the late 90s and the early part of Putin's presidency.
That's right, and I know Simon Johnson has written...
I spoke with this morning, actually, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, and he's where? He's at which blog?
I think it's called The Baseline Scenario.
The Baseline Scenario, exactly. And he makes the point, after he was with the IMF and dealt with these emerging developing countries and their oligarchies, and he says, you know, you just change the names, and that's exactly what's going on here. Let me tell people, I didn't give them we gave them your sports bio, but we didn't give them the rest, which is have written for, you author a column called Road Rage for Rolling Stone's print version and a weekly online at their website, rollingstone.com, called The Low Post. There's the sports metaphor. And your books include The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics, and religion, and two titles that show you have no special love for either of the national political parties. One was called Spanking the Donkey, and the other one was called Smells Like Dead Elephants. So, equal opportunity, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I mentioned your Rolling Stone article, which I think an awful lot of people saw and made a big buzz, called The Big Takeover. What I'd like to do is read one of the first paragraphs, just so people get a feel for it, and then let you respond to what you were saying there. The latest bailout came as AIG, this was the middle of March, the latest bailout came as AIG admitted to having just posted the largest quarterly loss in American corporate history, $61.7 billion. So in the final 3 months of last year, AIG lost more than $27 million every hour. That's $465,000 every minute, a yearly income for a median American household every 6 seconds, $7,750 a second. And all this happened at the end of 8 straight years that America devoted to frantically chasing the shadow of a terrorist threat to no avail, 8 years spent stopping every citizen at every airport to search every purse, bag, crotch, and briefcase for juice boxes and explosive tubes of toothpaste. Yet in the end, our government had no mechanism for searching the balance sheets of companies that held life or death power over our society and was unable to spot holes in the national economy the size of Libya, whose entire GDP was smaller than AIG's 2008 losses. Take it from there, Matt Taibbi.
Well, you know, I think one of the things we were trying to show in the article is the complete and utter lack of any kind of regulatory structure to watch out for a crisis like the one we ended up facing. One of the things that I thought was most shocking was that because of a series of changes in the way that companies were regulated in the late 90s, a company like AIG could choose its own regulator. All you had to do to choose the OTC, which is the Office, I'm sorry, OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, as your regulator, was to open up a thrift, which is just another word for a savings and loan, in any one of the 50 states. And AIG did that. They opened up a thrift in Delaware and ended up being regulated by the OTS, which had only one insurance expert on its entire staff. And this was a regulatory agency that was regulating AIG, Ameriprise, and all these enormous insurance companies, and they only had one expert on their staff.
And remember, I want to remind people, the scale of what just AIG was doing was so, so enormous that this is way beyond ludicrous. It's criminal.
No, it's unbelievable. I mean, there was basically, and you know, the thing about this is that not only was the government not paying attention, but they just weren't competent to really follow any of the developments in the economy. This stuff that AIG was involved with was so complicated that the people who were charged with regulating them simply didn't understand it. In fact, when AIG ended up having to get bailed out by the government, its regulator, the OTS, was not even in the room.
Oh my God.
There was nobody in that agency who was able to understand the transactions.
Wow. And let me read another quote from your article. You say, "It's all about the regulatory environment," says a government source involved with the AIG bailout. "These guys look for holes in the system, for ways they can do trades without government interference, and whatever is unregulated, all the action's going to pile into that."
Right. Exactly. And that's why you had, there are these instruments, the credit default swaps, that's why they became so enormously popular on Wall Street, was precisely because they were not regulated. There's nothing particularly interesting about a CDS. I mean, they do provide some aid to companies in terms of helping them keep their liquidity. It's very complicated, but the most interesting thing about a CDS and about all these different kinds of derivative instruments is that they're not regulated, and that allows especially the big companies to really have an advantage, because there's no central exchange, there's no clearinghouse, there's no regulation. So it's a situation where it's like a jungle. The biggest economic players have an enormous advantage, and so they racked it. They basically dumped almost all their speculative activity into that one particular arena where the government wasn't watching.
Right. A definition of two things: collateralized debt obligation, or CDO, and credit default swap, or CDS. And so a definition, and maybe how the role, how significant the role was they each played in the crisis.
Well, they're both extremely complicated, and it's probably not going to make a whole lot of sense when I try to get into it on the air. But
well, I'll tell you what then. Let me, less of an expert, try, and I'll give you what my sort of, what I've picked up along the way, and then you can refine it.
Okay.
Collateralized debt obligation is what they did when they started packing securities together. So,
right.
So in other words, it could be anything. It could be a bunch of debt for credit cards. It could be a bunch of mortgages. It could be any corporate debt.
Aircraft loans,
right.
Credit cards. Yes.
Right. But the deal is that in the old days, in the picture we learned in civics or Ec 1, right, it was that a bank, George Bailey in Bedford Falls made housing loans to immigrants in Bedford Falls, and they all got a piece of the American dream. That the bank that loaned the money held the loan, and your house was the collateral, or
right.
The bank that gave you the credit card, they gave you, and they had a contract with you. And so there was a relationship. What this was bundle a bunch of them together and sell them. Two things happen then. One is that you begin to lose the connection between the creditor and the debtor and any sort of relationship, any sort of responsibility and so on. The second thing is that once you start bundling them, you can throw in a bunch of gimmicky mortgages and subprime mortgages and credit card accounts that aren't ever going to be able to pay off, in with some other good stuff. And then the credit rating agencies, who I want to get to in a second, rate them as good loans, good securities, and they go on from there.
Right. Well, yeah. The really important thing with CDOs and with, you know, any kind of securitized derivative instrument is the way that it affected the credit rating agencies, because the basic principle is if you have 100 different loans and you put them all in a box and you say, you know, the top 10%, you know, as money flows into that box every month, the first, let's say that there's supposed to be $100 total into that box. Let's say the first $10 that goes into that box is going to go to a certain class of investors, and those are going to be your AAA rated investors. So since it's highly likely that you're going to get at least 10 out of that $100 every month, you can call that 10% slice a AAA rated tranche.
Okay.
This is basically a method by which you can take a whole bunch of crappy mortgages and crappy credit card loans and put them all in a box, and suddenly they're not, you know, triple B rated or junk rated. Suddenly at least a piece of them is triple A rated. And that was how you took a whole bunch of bad mortgages and put them all together and were able to sell them to really, really enormous institutional investors like pension funds and insurance companies, and, you know, who previously would have had no interest in those kinds of things before. But now they, because of these instruments, they had a market that they could sell, you know, these things to those people.
Now let me ask a question. So if I'm bundling those, and I know when I'm bundling them that a bunch of them were gimmicky mortgages that were going to have balloon payments that people couldn't make, subprime or not. There's a lot of gimmicky stuff. You know, people seem to think it's all about subprime. It's not. A lot of that gimmicky stuff was just as bad, even if it wasn't subprime.
Right.
That if I know it, where did the breakdown happen? Was it that the rating agencies turned a blind eye? Was it that the rating agencies didn't know what was in them? Was it that the rating agencies are just useless?
Well, the rating, I mean, there's a lot of factors at work here. One of the things that happened was that you had the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, and now you had the ratings agencies were, you know, basically in bed with the same people who they were rating.
They were getting paid for these ratings by the folks they were rating.
Right, exactly.
That was how they earned their income. And this is the same thing that was true of the accounting firms that blew it on Enron, WorldCom, Adelphi, and so on, and why Arthur Andersen went out of business.
Exactly. It's exactly the same principle. And because of that, there was a strong incentive by all these people to give good ratings to these CDOs. Also, there was also the fact that people, you know, even in the ratings agencies, just didn't understand them all that well. I actually talked to a woman, one of the women who helped invent the collateralized debt obligation. She worked for J.P. Morgan on a team that helped sort of, you know, perfect the method in the late 90s. And she says, you know, even to this day, she has clients who come to her and they say, hey, you know, I bought a whole bunch of this stuff from you guys 3 or 4 years ago, but I still don't understand how that worked. And that's true not only of you know, the common customers, but the people who are actually making these things and selling them and rating them everywhere.
So let me, because I'm particularly interested in this rating piece, because it seems to me if you are running a casino, you know it's a casino. If you're running something like Wall Street, it supposedly wasn't a casino, and the person that kind of you rely on for the trust, for confidence, for reality check, were the rating agencies. Now, at a certain point, it seems to me, they've seen what happened to Arthur Andersen. Arthur Andersen was a giant, respected, 100 years old, gone. So now they can see what they're doing. I mean, didn't they eventually say this is going to be bad for our business to be taking our reputation that we've earned? What I'm talking about is Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and I'm forgetting the third big one.
Yeah.
Okay, you are too.
Off the top of
okay.
my head. Yeah, I can't remember.
But there were three big ones, and they have, again, those kind of names that are, you know, that have been around forever and are what trust is all about. And they're now doing garbage rating. Isn't there someone, I mean, what I'm asking is, I haven't done it. I haven't seen an interview with someone from the rating field, but I'm imagining in your research, wasn't there some whistleblower that said, you know, this isn't, in the long run, this is going to ruin us because we're not doing our job. Or even a responsible person who says we play a specific role in the financial structure of this country and this global economy. And if we are fail, the whole thing could crash.
Well, actually, ironically enough, some of the people from J.P. Morgan who helped design a lot of these instruments were the first people to speak out about what was going on in the early part of this decade. You know, they one of the things that was happening is that the people who were writing a lot of these CDOs were arguing that they were safe because they were. You know, each one of these CDOs had lots of geographic diversity, and they would put like one mortgage from each of the 50 states into these CDOs, and they thought that was going to insulate them against a lot of defaults, because theoretically you wouldn't have defaults in all the different 50 states. But you know, there were people at J.P. Morgan, for instance, who were saying, "Hey, it doesn't matter where these mortgages are; they're all dependent on the same." Interest rates, they're all dependent on the same unemployment rates, and these things aren't safe, they're going to collapse. But people didn't listen to them, and even, you know, Alan Greenspan and, you know, the members of, and people like Richard Rubin and Larry Summers overruled objections to tighter regulations on this stuff, you know, when these objections started to come out.
And that was in the Clinton administration, yes?
Right. Well, that continued actually after the Clinton administration too. Greenspan continued to sort of lobby against any kind of regulation against.
Right. And that phrase, even Alan Greenspan, I think is, you know, it's like I remember when it was that swimmer. It was, you know, Derry Torres at the age of 41, and it's now like even Alan Greenspan. But I mean, even Alan Greenspan is like one of the main. Okay. How about credit default swaps? So if people think they kind of get a sense of what this collateralized debt obligation was, which was bundling a range of securities into something which then went through the system as if it was solid, a credit default swap.
All right. Well, let's say that you have a mortgage, right? And I go to my father and I say, I'm going to bet that that Terry defaults on his mortgage, right? And what's going to happen is, I pay my father $1,000 a month, but if as long as you keep up your payments. But if you happen to default in your mortgage, then my father pays me the full amount of your mortgage in cash. This is basically a way for companies to hedge their bets in like the housing market. So it's really just a bet on a third party's debt. That's really all it is.
Okay, so let's get that straight. So in other words, and the key thing I think here that's so interesting and crazy about it is that it's a third party. In other words, it isn't the person. A credit default swap doesn't necessarily involve the person who loaned the money, the person who owes the money. It's two other people saying, "I bet that's going to fail."
Right.
And because of the leverage, right? It got even worse. And then you say that there were naked deals, right? And that's what I've been describing, which neither one of them holds the underlying loan. And the crazy thing about these naked deals in which these bets are going on is that
nobody has to put up any money.
Not only that, but they can do it the same bet over and over again with different parties.
Right. Yeah. You can do it over and over again, or 1,000 different people can do it on the same. In other words, it might not just be me and my father betting on your mortgage. It might be, you know, everybody in my town betting on your mortgage. And that way, if you default, all the people who bet against you, or I'm sorry, who bet on you, are suddenly going to owe the full value of your mortgage. That's how we turn, you know, a few defaults here and there into hundreds of billions or even trillions of dollars of debt overnight, because these enormous amounts of debt just sort of accumulated out of thin air.
Now, we went over it with the credit default obligation. In the credit default swap, what is the motivation for it? It sounds like what it is that if the bubble is continuing and no one's defaulting on mortgages, then it's one thing, and if the bubble bursts, then it's a crisis. But what was the motivation? I think I read somewhere that there were $62 trillion in credit default swaps outstanding, which dwarfs the GDP of the world by several times, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, There are two basic motivations for buying a credit default swap, well, aside from the purely speculative aspect, which I'm not even going to get into. But the big ones are, let's say you're Goldman Sachs and you're heavily invested in the housing bubble. So what you can do is you can buy credit default swaps against housing debt. So if there are a whole bunch of defaults and a lot of those investments go wrong, you're going to get paid on the other side by somebody like AIG. That's why, you know, Goldman Sachs, for instance, had purchased almost $20 billion worth of CDS protection against primarily housing investments from AIG. So the principle here is it's like shorting a stock, basically. It's just mm-hmm. another way to hedge a bet. That's one great reason. And the other reason is if it's hard to explain, but if you buy CDS protection on an investment that you have, accounting regulators considered that you didn't even have that liability on your balance sheet, and they allowed you to lend more. So does that make any sense?
Well, I think what it does is it's saying there are rules about right. banking. You have to have a certain amount of capital assets to cover
right.
what you, but this, because as we said earlier, people went where there was no regulation. This one didn't count on your balance sheet. So all the commissions
right.
that were making, all the profits you were making, you could get way extended because this, you didn't have to hold capital in proportion to that, which is another reason that when it crashes so much worse.
Right. That was the original rationale behind a CDS. It was a way for banks to get around the restrictions on how much capital they had to have in their balance sheet.
Riff on this quote.
Okay.
The mistake most people make in looking at the financial crisis is thinking of it in terms of money. But if you look at it in purely Machiavellian terms, what you see is a colossal power grab that threatens to turn the federal government into a kind of giant Enron, a huge, impenetrable black box filled with self-dealing insiders whose scheme is the securing of individual profits at the expense of an ocean of unwitting, involuntary shareholders, previously known as taxpayers.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, look what happened. These enormous bailout programs that we've gotten ourselves into are basically dialogues between the federal government and the Federal Reserve and these companies like Goldman Sachs and, you know, J.P. Morgan Stanley and Citibank, and they all have to sort of participate in these pseudo-secret programs like the Public-Private Investment Program and all these Federal Reserve lending facilities like the TALF, which, you know, it's an enormous leap up in terms of the access that these banks have to public money. They just didn't have this access before, and now they're participating in all these programs. And, you know, the very survival of the American government is tied to the success or failure of these banks. I mean, we're so heavily invested in these people now that we just can't let them fail. And that wouldn't have happened if they hadn't failed so spectacularly in the last few years. So it's actually kind of politically a win for them because they're more important and they're more you know, protected than they ever were before.
Okay, and just if I give you a minute and a half, what should listeners be paying attention to? What should they be doing?
Well, I think that people really need to educate themselves and listen to people who are probably more articulate than me about these programs. But I mean, for instance, this so-called public-private investment program that the Treasury just passed, which is really just a trillion-dollar giveaway to hedge funds, you know, and that happened, and it was like there wasn't a peep at all from the public about it. But the President Obama passes a stimulus package, which was for a significantly less amount of money, there was sort of widespread public anger about it. But, you know, we need to look at these trillions of dollars that are going out the door through the Fed and through the Treasury and through the FDIC and ask what's happening to all this money, because people just aren't paying attention. And I think it's the problem is that they're intimidated by the economics of it, the finances, and how these instruments work. And I think we need to pay more attention to that.
Okay. So again, you can learn more about Matt Taibbi's work at TrueSlant.com, Alternet.org, and RollingStone.com. Thank you, Matt Taibbi. Keep up the good work.